This episode of Let's Talk About Chef is being brought to you by the New York Times. Right now, you can get access to the world's greatest newspaper for only $1 a week. Right now, it is so important that we get our news from trusted sources, and the New York Times has been the most trusted name in journalism for over 169 years. There are journalists all over the world in war zones and dangerous places trying to bring you the real stories of what's happening in our world. And for the insulting to their efforts and sacrifice price of $1 a week, you can get a subscription. $4 a week to be the smartest person you know. Head on over to newyorktimes.com to get started. Coca-Cola is everywhere. It is by far one of the most powerful brands that has ever existed on the planet. Every single day, more than 1.9 billion servings are consumed in over 200 countries. Each year in America alone, the company makes an annual profit of around $31 billion. And in the USA, Americans consume around 1.7 million tons or 10.8 pounds of sugar a year by drinking Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has a 42.5% share of the global drinks market. Coca-Cola, as we all know, doesn't just make Coca-Cola. They make so many different types of drinks under different names and companies that if you were to drink one a day, every single day, it would take you 9 years to try them all. Coke makes so much money every year that as a company, they are the 84th biggest economy in the world. The 85th biggest economy is Costa Rica. The company is worth more than Pepsi, Red Bull, Starbucks, and Budweiser combined, and they get bigger every single year. If you stacked every single Coca-Cola vending machine into a pile, it would be the size of 4 Empire State Buildings. Coca-Cola is insane. They are one of the largest companies on the planet, and with their commercials and ads of wholesome families enjoying the sugary beverage, you would never think that a company this big and this powerful would have such a strange and oddly dark history. But as we always do on Let's Talk About Chef, today we're going to open up the lid and peer into the past. From Nazis to morphine-addicted pharmacists and even Santa Claus, it's the real story of Coca-Cola. On April 16, 1865, the American Civil War was raging, and in Columbus, Georgia, in the last battle of the war, John Pemberton was slashed in the chest by a sword. As he lay there close to death, bleeding heavily on the battlefield, he was picked up and brought to the medical tent. Doctors, not knowing what to do to attempt to try and save him, gave him a massive dose of morphine, expecting him to die peacefully. As they continued to give him, frankly, astonishing amounts of morphine over the next few hours, John started to recover and then miraculously survived. With the war coming to an end and a fairly serious and newly acquired addiction to morphine, he headed to Atlanta and opened a pharmacy so that he could have free access to morphine all of the time. Now, John's story of being addicted to the painkiller after the war was nothing new. Thousands of soldiers on both sides of the fight had become addicts. And for 10 years, John fed his habit by running the pharmacy, and after a decade of near constant drug use, decided that he wanted to quit. Medicine in the 1870s was basically a non-science, and most ailments were being treated by drinking tonics and tinctures. John had heard rumors that coca wine from France was a good way to ease your body off of opioids, and so he set out to try and make his own in his pharmacy. The result was Pemberton's French Wine Coca Nerve Tonic, and it was a very strong alcohol mixed with cocaine and marketed as the cure for such things as opiate addiction, upset stomach, headaches, and even erectile dysfunction. His coca wine was made in large batches of thick molasses-like syrup and delivered to other pharmacies where it could be mixed with soda water and bottled out to patients and customers. By 1886, Prohibition was sweeping across Georgia, and so Pemberton modified his alcohol-based tonic to be non-alcoholic. He added a lot of cocaine to it because despite alcohol being made illegal, cocaine wasn't. There was even a press release to celebrate the non-alcohol coca tonic. This intellectual beverage and temperance drink contains valuable tonic and nerve stimulant, properties of the coca plant and cola nuts, and makes not only for a delicious, exhilarating, and refreshing beverage dispensed from the soda water fountain or in other carbonated beverages, but a valuable brain tonic and a cure for all nervous affections, sick headache, hysteria, and melancholy. The peculiar flavor of Coca-Cola delights every palate, and is dispensed from soda fountains in the same manner as any of the fruit syrups. The real genius behind Pemberton's drink was that he wasn't setting up stores everywhere to sell it. As its popularity grew across the South, he set up manufacturing plants to produce it and then would ship it to other pharmacies. By not having to pay for facilities there in his own factory, coca wine became one of the most sought-after medicinal drinks, mostly because it got you high. Despite promising that his drink would cure addiction to opiates, John hadn't managed to kick his habit, and his addiction and near-constant use of morphine resulted in him dying of an overdose in 1888. After Pemberton died, all sorts of people came out of the woodwork to try and say that they were the new owners of John's Coca-Cola. By this time, the cocaine amount had been reduced and sweeteners had been added to make it more of a soda pop. One of his partners, Asa Candler, came forward and said that he had bought a controlling stake from John right before he died, although he didn't have a contract or any documentation at all, and the fact that John didn't know he was going to die from an overdose cast serious suspicion against him. John's own son, Charlie, claimed that he held the rights to the brand name, stating that he was the only one who knew the recipe. Other partners and associates came forward, all claiming that they were the rightful owners of Coca-Cola, and in the end, Chandler did quite possibly the most American thing ever. He just gave everyone money to walk away. And by 1891, he was the controlling owner of the company after spending $3,000 buying up the shares and rights of family members. Although it may seem kind of crazy that Chandler was able to take over the entire company, he was the one who had designed the now famous logo of flowing Spencerian script that was so popular. It was so popular that Budweiser and the Ford Motor Company copied it. Chandler was something of a business genius, and even before John had died, he had dispensed thousands of pieces of paper in newspapers and magazines that could be redeemed for a glass of Coca-Cola, spreading its popularity. These little pieces of paper were later called coupons, which Coca-Cola invented. These coupons were so popular that between 1894 and 1913, one in every nine Americans drank a glass of Coca-Cola for free. Although Chandler was focused on selling the cola syrup to pharmacies and soda fountain shops, he eventually decided that it would make sense to start bottling the already mixed beverage in glass bottles. And in 1891, he struck a deal with a Vicksburg bottle distributor to start bottling and selling Coca-Cola. By 1898, the federal government started taxing medicine, and so the Coca-Cola company stopped pretending that their drink was medicine and focused solely on selling it to soda fountain shops for soda pop. They marketed their drink as a refreshing beverage, not medicine, and also decided that showing images of happy families and children drinking Coke would be the smartest thing to do. It should be noted that most people in a blind taste test usually pick Pepsi over Coke, but if you can see the red can of Coca-Cola, people usually choose it over Pepsi nearly 98% of the time. By 1900, Coke had set its sights on global domination, and Charlie, the son of John, traveled to Europe to try and drum up interest in the beverage that had taken over America. But people in Europe couldn't understand why you would want to drink something without alcohol in it. In Germany, adults scoffed at the idea of drinking anything other than beer or wine or booze, and in France, the population simply refused to drink something that was American. It wasn't until 1919, when Ernest Woodruff, the new president of Coca-Cola, set his sights on conquering Europe again. Woodruff had started his career as a truck salesman for the White Motor Company, before becoming its general manager and saving enough money to buy Coca-Cola. He instantly realized that selling syrups was pointless overseas, as soda shops were an American invention. So he focused on selling the bottles of soda. To accomplish this, he didn't make a new bottle or advertise overseas. He created a bright red metal cooler with the Coca-Cola logo on the front, and then had its dimensions fit perfectly for brand new six-packs of Coke that he designed. He also invented the vending machine, the classic glass-fronted machines that held cold bottles of Coke that were dispensed for a nickel. Then, in 1926, Woodruff took a page out of the previous owner's Chandler and started giving away free bottles of cold Coca-Cola on hot days all across Europe. Once people had a taste of the stuff for free, Woodruff even marketed the drink as a fun, refreshing import from exciting America, with posters of cowboys and famous film stars drinking it. They even developed a special bottle for the European market that looked like a wine bottle, and even had a gold foil seal over the cap. The theory being that the French would drink it if it looked like wine or champagne. In 1928, the American Olympic team showed up to the Olympics in Amsterdam, sponsored by Coca-Cola, and handed out over 40,000 bottles of the pop to anyone that would take them. The 1920s and early 30s were good to Coca-Cola, who was very quickly becoming the drink of choice for Europeans. But then a man with a small mustache and the Nazi Party took over Germany, and everything changed.
Somebody's been doing a lot of walking and getting more and more worn out, because by the time a woman assembles a complete spring wardrobe, she's generally covered a lot of floor space in a lot of stores. So it's little wonder that smart shoppers everywhere take time out to pause and refresh. And where else but in the fountain where they serve ice-cold Coca-Cola? Almost everyone appreciates the best, and the bright tang of Coke is always welcome after a busy day of shopping. The bracing sparkle and the bit of quick energy you get in Coke makes it the perfect refreshment every time. It gives you a bright little lift. It brings you back so refreshed so quickly. What the song says is really true.
There are times every day as you work or you play when a pause would be welcome to you. And it's then that you find the bright thought in your mind that only a Coke will do.
50 million times a day, at home, at work, or on the way, there's nothing like a Coca-Cola, nothing like a Coke.
Yes, for a bright taste and a bracing sparkle, for perfect refreshment every time, there's nothing like ice-cold Coca-Cola.
There's nothing like a Coca-Cola.
In the lead-up to 1933, the German Coca-Cola Company was being run by Ray Irvington Powers. Under his command, the soda had sold almost 100,000 cases, up from 6,000 cases in years previous, because Powers would promise to shopkeepers things like they would be able to buy their own villa in Florida and get insanely wealthy if they sold the stuff. But Powers also hated bookkeeping, and he ignored hundreds of bills that would pile up in his office. The direct result of this was that the German Coca-Cola Company was basically in financial ruin and in serious need of accounting and management. When Hitler rose to power in 1933, it marked a change in Germany and a massive change for Coca-Cola. The president, Woodruff, appointed a 30-year-old German man named Max Keith in charge of the company in Germany to try and get things under control. Keith was apparently a terrifying and imposing figure, and with the German economy booming under the Third Reich, he started advertising the soft drink to the hard-working people of his country. He did this by removing the all-American ideology that went with drinking Coca-Cola and changed it to a drink that is worthy of the German people, essentially soft drink propaganda. And it worked. By 1936, the Summer Olympics were held in Berlin, and they were the perfect opportunity for Keith to market the brand to the German people. During the games, the Coca-Cola logo would be seen on banners waving next to giant red and black swastikas. It's important to point out here that all of this allegiance with Hitler and his Nazi party was done in full cooperation with the American headquarters of Coca-Cola in Atlanta. Now, Woodruff wasn't a fan of the Nazi Party, but other American businessmen like Henry Ford were. Woodruff decided to follow the lead of Walter Teagle, who was the head of Standard Oil, and not publicly take a side, so that they could continue to do business in Nazi-led Germany. Woodruff even worked with a German bank to ensure that Coca-Cola syrup could continue to be brought in from America. Then, in 1937, a rival soda pop maker in Germany traveled to the United States and visited the Coca-Cola factory, where they saw Coke bottle caps with Hebrew writing on them. The writing was to show that Coca-Cola was kosher. But the rival pop maker claimed that back in Germany, that to the press, that Coca-Cola was being run by Harold Hirsch, who was a Jewish man on the board of directors, and sales of Coca-Cola plummeted in Germany. As a result, to try and gain back popularity against the German people, Keitz started to advertise at Nazi youth rallies, driving huge trucks with Coca-Cola signs on the side around the rallies and handing out free soda to the German teenagers who had worked up a thirst screaming Heil Hitler at the Führer. At a conference in 1938, Keitz gave a rousing speech, where he said, "We know we will reach our goal only if we muster all our powers in a total effort. Our marvelous drink has the power of endurance to continue this march to success," aligning his soft drink with the war efforts of the Nazi Party, and that was just beginning to rumble to life. Despite never fully joining the Nazi Party himself, Keitz worked closely with the Third Reich to keep his company at the forefront of their efforts, so that more and more Germans would turn to Coca-Cola. So much so that in 1939, when Hitler turned 50 and Coca-Cola Germany turned 10 years old, at that celebration, Keitz stood in front of the crowd that gathered to celebrate both birthdays and made everyone Sieg Heil loudly, saying that it was to commemorate our deepest admiration and gratitude for our Führer, who has led our nation into a brilliant higher sphere. Meanwhile, back in the United States, Woodruff worked closely with Keitz to ensure that Coca-Cola sold in record numbers every year. But when the war effort ramped up, the Nazi Party started to punish foreign businesses. When Hitler invaded Poland in 1939 and declared war on Europe, Keitz was worried that his American-owned business would be seized by the government. Then, on December 7, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and the United States entered the war and declared Germany an enemy. The American government used the 1917 Trading with the Enemy Act to force a full embargo on the Axis powers, and Woodruff and Keitz were forced to cut ties. And Keitz's contact and massive amount of Coca-Cola syrup that was being shipped over to him from America was halted. Now, Coca-Cola wasn't the only international company that was forced to stop making products. But Keitz was determined to move ahead and make something, and so he started designing an exclusively German-made soda that was vaguely similar to Coke. It was caffeinated and had an unusual and unidentifiable taste. But rather than being made with Coca-Cola's secret 7X flavoring, this drink was made with the leftover scraps from other food industries, mostly leftover fruit and vegetables that had gone bad before they could be sold, like apple pulp from cider pressing, and actually whey, the liquid that is produced by cheese curdling. The resulting liquid was a beige color that looked kind of like ginger ale. Keitz asked his employees to explore their fantasies when looking for a new name, and the drink was eventually called Fanta. At this time, Fanta was all Keitz had to keep the company afloat. But fortunately for Coca-Cola and Keitz, Fanta was also all that Germany had. With virtually no other soft drinks made in the country, Fanta's popularity exploded. Because of its popularity, Hitler let Fanta ignore the sugar rationing that was taking place in Germany, and it became the sweetest drink available on the market. This made it popular in Germany for adding it to soups and stews to act as a sweetener and thickener instead of using sugar, which was being bought and sold on the black market. Keitz then used his connections with the Nazi Party to gain control over all other European Coca-Cola factories that were sitting vacant all over the Third Reich-controlled areas. This allowed him to spread Fanta all across Europe and keep those factories from shutting down by supplying German soldiers. Keitz sold over 3 million cases of Fanta in Germany before the war was over. When Allied forces eventually brought down the Nazis, production of Fanta stopped, and Keitz handed all of the millions of dollars he had made selling his Nazi soda during the war to Coca-Cola headquarters in America. Woodruff then appointed Keitz to be the head of Coca-Cola in all of Europe. The Fanta we know today was rebranded as Fanta Orange in Italy in 1955. It was a vibrant orange and used local citrus instead of leftover food scraps. This new makeover was an attempt to distance Coca-Cola from its history of dealing with the Nazis. And today, Fanta has over 100 different flavors as one of the world's most popular sodas. In 2015, Coca-Cola released a commercial celebrating 75 years of Fanta, and referred to the years of its creation, that is, during World War II and selling its Hitler-approved beverage to Germans and soldiers, as the Good Times. After a public uproar, it was taken down. When Coca-Cola was asked about the incident, they released a statement saying that Fanta, during its 75-year history, had no association with Hitler or the Nazi Party. A blatant lie.
I work in a factory, and when I take a break, I cool off with a Coke.
I work in an office, and when I start to fade, I spring back with a Coke.
I don't work at all. I just stay home and enjoy Coke all the time.
Coca-Cola puts you at your sparkling best. Bring home the Coke.
There is a myth that Coca-Cola invented Santa Claus, and that isn't true. But before the 1950s, Father Christmas was a lean, tall man in a brown suit. But when Coca-Cola started advertising the magic of Christmas not being complete without Coca-Cola, they had a character called Santa Claus who was fat, with bright red cheeks and a white beard and a bright red suit created for them. They originally ran the ad so that families would associate Christmas with Coca-Cola. And since then, the image of Santa Claus as we know him today comes from the soda pop company. Not only was this new, fat, jolly Santa born, but also outdoor advertising. Coca-Cola would plaster every available surface with signs from small-town general stores to Times Square in New York. You couldn't drive for 10 minutes in any direction without seeing the bright red Coca-Cola sign, especially at Christmas time.
Enjoy ice-cold Coca-Cola, sign of good taste.
In the end, the history of most major globally dominating companies can be full of secrets that would make most people's heads turn. These secrets are not hard to find, and Coca-Cola isn't really the worst of them by far. For example, Kellogg's Corn Flakes were invented as a way to stop people from masturbating. Mountain Dew is another name for moonshine, and the drink was invented as a mixer for the blinding alcohol that was made in backyard stills during American Prohibition. Lululemon founder Chip Wilson has said that the reason he named his company Lululemon was because he thought it would be funny to hear Japanese people try and pronounce it. Volkswagen was invented by Hitler. Mercedes-Benz was also very good at giving cars to Hitler with bulletproof glass, and even used thousands of Jewish people in forced labor in its factories during World War II, which they had to pay $12 million in reparations in 1998 to families of workers who died in terrible factory conditions. As I mentioned before, Henry Ford, of the Ford Motor Company, was an anti-Semite and a Nazi sympathizer who became the first American recipient of the Grand Cross of the Supreme Order of the German Eagle, which signified the admiration that Ford and Hitler had for one another, and Ford also supplied the Nazi army with engines and trucks at the start of the war. Domino's Pizza founder Tom Monahan forms political action groups with his massive profits from the pizza chain to campaign against same-sex marriage and abortion rights. TGI Fridays founder Alan Stillman opened the first TGIs in Manhattan as a way to meet and sleep with airline stewardesses and models who were moving into his neighborhood. The sheer amount of sex that one could have after drinking at the bar resulted in it being responsible for ushering in the sexual revolution of the late 60s into suburban American neighborhoods. There. That was a lot. That was a lot of bad things. Oh, but we are not done yet. Nike has long been known to outsource manufacturing to Asian countries, and in 1992, reports of sweatshop-like conditions and child labor were confirmed. It took Nike another 10 years to do audits of their own. Also, their famous slogan, "Just Do It," was derived from the last words of murderer Gary Gilmore, who just before facing the firing squad said, "Let's do it." Ingvar Kamprad, in 1943, founded IKEA, and he was also an ardent member and recruiter for Sweden's own Nazi-aligned fascist party during World War II, and in 1948, 3 years after the war ended, personally bankrolled the printing of Swedish Nazi Party's leader Per Engels' political manifesto. Nestle, yes, the chocolate company, for decades used advertising in third world countries to get mothers hooked on using their powdered infant formula, ignoring the studies that said that feeding a baby breast milk in those countries would increase a baby's chance of survival by 6 times. The widespread distribution and use of Nestle's formula resulted in 1 million infant deaths per year from malnutrition, and led to the 1981 government mandate on what can be considered a breast milk substitute. The German subsidiary of the American computer company International Business Machines, or IBM, played an integral and very profitable and absolutely terrifying role in executing Hitler's plan to disenfranchise and execute tens of thousands of Jews within the Third Reich. Basically, the company leased custom-designed punch card machines and sorting machines, basically early computers, to concentration camps, and even trained Nazi officers on how to use them to make their extermination more successful and efficient. So, all of that sounds pretty bad. And finally, in summary, Coca-Cola was invented so that its morphine-addicted founder could have easy access to his drug of choice, eventually inventing the drink that is bought 1.9 billion times a day to try and replace an opioid. The American company then hooked up with Hitler to make millions during World War II, and then lied about it in 2015. It has spent the last several decades advertising that they are a family-friendly and wonderful company whose wholesome product that can take rust off of a car bumper is refreshing. It's crazy, isn't it?
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and...
Thanks to everyone for listening to this week's episode of Let's Talk About Chef. It was written by me, Brian Clark. If you want to write into the podcast, you can send everything to letstalkaboutchef@gmail.com. As always, have a great service and have a great week.